Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast. All right, let's say you want Matt to invest in space, as in
I do.
The cosmos. There is an ETF for that, the Procure Space ETF. Ticker symbol, you guessed it, UFO. Andrew Shannon, Chief Executive Officer of Procure AM, joins us this morning. Andrew, a lot of interest growing in the commercialization of space. We're looking at the SpaceX launch last Friday. Talk to us about your space ETF. What's in your space ETF?
Thanks so much for having me. So we launched UFO back in April of 2019, and we've seen the space industry go through some dramatic changes that's really opening up for the commercialization of the space industry. And so someone looking to invest in UFO will notice that the underlying index that our fund tracks actually focuses with at least 80% of the weight of the fund is actually in companies deriving a majority of their revenues from space, while up to 20% of the underlying index can focus on some more diversified companies that are major players in the space industry. Think your diversified aerospace and defense names, your Lockheed's and Boeing's. But because it's not the largest driver of their revenues, that entire tranche is capped at 20%. So you're really looking at companies that are deriving significant revenues from space. So satellite companies, launch providers, companies that are relying upon space-based systems and services. So communications is a major driver, as well as satellite operators and manufacturers as well.
What? So I see your top 10 holdings include Dish Network, which makes sense because the satellites, Garmin, I guess, also. Sirius XM, which a lot of people are listening to us on Sirius XM. What about the explorers, like Virgin Galactic, for example, or I know Blue Origin and SpaceX aren't publicly accessible, but do you see a future in which we can be owning, you know, companies that make rockets and take people to outer space?
Yeah, so you're already getting exposure to those companies in the fund. So you know, many people aren't familiar, but Boeing and Lockheed actually have a joint venture called the United Launch Alliance, which helps send things to outer space. Virgin Galactic, like you mentioned, is a holding specializing in space tourism. They're still working on their product and experience to be able to safely bring people to outer space. But some of those kind of topics that you're already mentioning are things that are already in the fund. And so although SpaceX, being a private company, isn't in the fund, their ability to help lower the cost of sending things to outer space is actually benefiting many companies in the portfolio. So think a company like Maxar, which helps build satellites. Well, if to the extent that someone can now purchase a satellite from Maxar and send it to outer space for significantly less than they could maybe even just 5 years ago, is now opening up for significantly more clients for the space industry. So they're already having knock-on effects. And then you look at this launch that they helped NASA send people to the ISS just this past week. And it's almost like a BOGO special that SpaceX is offering for its clients, where NASA used to spend over $80 million a seat to send an astronaut to the ISS. It's now coming in the $40 million range. So that frees up more budget for space agencies like the ESA, NASA, and beyond.
So, Andrew, do you believe there'll be more space-oriented companies coming to the public markets? Will there be more opportunities for investors to invest in what appears to be a growing commercialization of space?
We certainly hope so. And you're already seeing it in the SPAC market. There's been eight or so companies that have been named as the targets for potential SPAC mergers. Our fund doesn't invest in a company that is a SPAC until it actually de-SPACs and the merger has fully gone through. So there is opportunity for more companies as they go public, whether via a de-SPAC, an IPO, or even spinoffs. That could find their way into UFO. But right now, there's over 30 companies from around the world with a space focus that you could currently get exposure to in the fund. But we're not capped at the amount of companies that can be added. So we certainly will welcome more companies with a pure play space focus in the future.
How big is this industry and what kind of growth should we expect?
Yeah, so the Space Foundation puts out the space report annually, and I believe in roughly July we should get the numbers for 2020. But in 2019, it was roughly a $424 billion industry. And you look at different research houses and banks, Morgan Stanley's predicting by over $1 trillion by 2040. Bank of America actually predicts that the industry will be about $2.7 trillion by 2045. Right now, roughly one-third of the commercial market is actually communications companies. And if you look at what these different banks are saying is going to be the main driver for the space industry in the next 20 years or so, they point to broadband internet and communications. And that's something that our fund already has a pretty significant exposure to. So, you can't really play the space industry without, incorporating communications and broadband internet and some of these other companies that are going to be driving that, potential growth. So, right now that's kind of the composition of the fund, but certainly as more areas like even resource extraction and infrastructure build out in outer space, even the militarization and defense of space, which is something that hasn't gotten a ton of attention, but it's clearly picking up. All these are areas that people could potentially get exposure to currently and in the future.
Andrew, is there any sense that SpaceX will go public at any time in the future?
Well, certainly Elon Musk likes to tease that idea. He's mentioned that potentially he would spin off Starlink, which is their satellite network business. Before going public with SpaceX, and he's even said that he wouldn't go public with SpaceX until we have people on Mars. Who knows if those timelines are accurate, but certainly there are some really ambitious hopes. But there's also plenty of demand for investing in SpaceX through the private markets, and we've seen through stock and through debt. Your Canadian pensions have had a very huge interest in investing in space, even beyond just SpaceX. But they've been able to access capital pretty easily, and they've had some tremendous success. So, maybe not a real rush for them, but if the time's right, I wouldn't put it past Elon Musk to bring another company public.
All right, we appreciate that, Andrew. Really fascinating discussion there. Andrew Shannon, CEO of Procure AM. Again, they are the only pure play space ETF. It trades under the symbol UFO. So if you want exposure to space, Matt, there you go.
Yeah, and it seems like something, the kind of exposure that you want to have on the very long term, right? You want to just take this, put it in your pocket, and not look at it for, I was going to say 20 years, but probably 10 years is... we should be at Mars by then, right? 10 years?
Yeah, it would be. I tell you what, it's nice having Elon Musk there supporting the commercial space flight. And boy, if SpaceX ever were to consider going public, I think there would be huge demand because A, it's Elon Musk, but B, it's space. It's pretty cool. And you can think about some of the commercial aspects going forward.
Now let's get over to a company called Emblem. MBLM, Emblem. They've disemboweled their name, which is very trendy lately. I think Aberdeen did the same this morning. Aberdeen. Mario Natarelli joins us. He's a managing partner at Emblem. And Mario, you've recently conducted your brand intimacy COVID study. It's difficult, I think, for listeners to imagine what that is. Brand intimacy makes my childish mind think of Victoria's Secret. But when you put it together with COVID, I guess it makes sense with COVID also, Netflix and chill. But what exactly is the brand intimacy study?
Oh, sure. Disemboweled and Victoria's Secret. That's a great intro. So brand intimacy is, we make decisions based on emotion. Behavioral scientists have proven that. And yet most of what we do in the branding and marketing world is rationally driven. So what we wanted to do was measure not just how brands perform, but how do people feel about the brands that they use and love. So we're 11 years in on the science of understanding the bonds that we build with the brands that we love.
All right. What did we learn the pandemic? I'm guessing, obviously the pandemic upended our daily lives to so many different degrees. What did you find in terms of which brands performed well during this pandemic?
Yeah, it was... we did the study twice, pre and post pandemic, and we weren't sure what we were going to discover. What we found out is that people bonded with brands more during the pandemic than prior. Brands that we thought would do extremely well, like Apple and Amazon, continued to thrive and, of course, did very well. And then, no surprise to many, Zoom, Purell and Netflix were fast risers and took advantage of our, you know, sequestered lives.
So the biggest winners during the COVID period were USAA. Is that right? The United States Automobile Association?
No, when it comes to insurance financial company. Services?
Ah, the insurance company. Yeah. I got it. Okay, USAA, I'm USAA, reading, as a right. gearhead, is a different thing than the banking and insurance conglomerate. How did they land in first place?
Yeah, good question. So financial services do historically very poorly in our study, which is a little ironic that the people we trust with our money, we don't have strong emotional bonds with. But USAA finished first in our ranking post-COVID. This is a brand that really understands community. It's oriented around service members, really understands how you emotionally bond and connect with its stakeholders. So probably no surprise. It is interesting that most of the financial service brands that did well are not the typical iconic retail banks. So PayPal, USAA, even TD Bank rose up in the rankings. Credit cards and the big banks all did as poorly as they usually do in this study.
I'm going to go out there and say I think USAA does stand for United Services Automobile Association, although we just call it USAA. I think that's the actual name for it.
All right, we'll check.
At least Wikipedia is showing me that right now. Anyway, who else did well?
Overall in the study, you know, it's interesting. Brands that sort of harken back to kind of fond memories of the past or kind of comfort-related brands, like Campbell's, for example, did extremely well post-COVID. Ben & Jerry's, for a brand that's all about indulgence, did extremely well. Automotive brands, surprisingly, withheld and did pretty well during COVID, which we thought they would take a hit, but they didn't. So those are just some of the brands that were strong performers.
All right, Mario, I'm a Wall Street guy. I don't really don't care about brands. I think, you know, marketing is just, you know, paint it blue and sell it to me.
Well, let me tell you why you're wrong.
Please tell me, as a stock investor, do I care about brand value?
So here's the deal. We rank the most intimate brands, and then we compare them to the top performing brands in the Fortune 500 and Standard & Poor's Index. Our brands outperform those in revenue and profit every year, short-term and long-term. So if you aren't paying attention to this, you're missing something.
I mean, the power of brands, Paul, is huge. Look at Ferrari. You think Race could get a valuation like that if it weren't for the brand?
Yep, good point.
I guess the margins help as well. So who do you think is going to stick in terms – because – you know, maybe post-COVID, when the lockdown's over, we're not going to see consumers care as much about PayPal as they did during, you know, their online shopping extravaganza.
I think PayPal's done very well in our study over the 10 years. Brands that are going to recede, maybe Purell probably won't stick as long, or maybe Zoom may fade a little. I think those brands are working aggressively to build a product that's going to resonate with us beyond the pandemic. I think the brands that did extremely well, like Amazon and Apple, you know, increased their leads and built stronger kind of portfolios. I think they're going to, you know, see that advantage continue, obviously. Let me just say one more thing about brands. You know, what's interesting is that brands that are hardware related, smartphone brands, do extremely well and better than the content or the apps or the services on the phone. So another thing to kind of think about is the role that technology plays in building intimacy.
Hey, Mario, thank you so much. We really appreciate that very interesting study. Mario Natarelli from Emblem, talking to us about brand intimacy and the value of brands. And, you know, Matt, I kind of asked that question facetiously because I have seen a lot of studies that show a positive correlation between brand value and shareholder returns here. And you bring up a great example. You know, Ferrari and some of these other mega brands that
I heard the sarcasm in your. I knew you were trying to, you know, play the devil's advocate to some extent. So yeah. I think it makes sense, though. I mean, especially I think we've learned more about the strength of brands during COVID than we knew.
All right, thanks very much, Mario. We appreciate it. All right, let's get our latest update on all things Wall Street. We do that with Shanali Basak, Bloomberg Wall Street reporter. Shanali, love to talk to you about. You know, ESG investing has kind of been a little bit of a theme today for us, and it comes on the heels of the Biden climate summit, the global summit from last week here. What's the perspective of kind of
in our own
ESG
summit kicking off today? No,
yeah, exactly. And kind of I'll just get a sense of what's the feeling from Wall Street's perspective as to is this really a long-term investment theme that will be with us for some time?
Well, yeah, that's the most important thing. It has to be long-term because none of these things change over time. And with a lot of these issues, right, namely climate and also with social issues, namely race, they have been problems that have been brewing for a long time. And frankly, the financial industry has exacerbated in a lot of ways. So, you know, at the end of the day, you look back to the people who are counting on these investors, right? The people who have their pension funds at stake that have been very vocal and very loud and forcing these changes that, you know, really the large asset managers are really starting to step up now, but hopefully kept to be held accountable to.
So we have, as I said, this Green Summit kicking off today. It's a two-day summit. There's some huge names. I know Francine Lacqua talked to Al Gore. He's got to be kind of the poster politician for the green movement. And you're going to talk to Melody Hobson later today, who runs Ariel Investments. But she's also, I mean, she's the chairwoman of Starbucks, but she used to be the chair at DreamWorks as well. A huge career here. What does she have to say about ESG?
Yeah, it's really interesting because she's a major board member, right? She's on the board of JP Morgan and, as you said, chair of Starbucks. So she has influence in that way. But they're also an investor, right, over at Ariel Investments. And so how do they vote with their feet, right? How do they hold companies to account? What we're finding is two sorts of approaches, right? You have this terminal headline right now on BlackRock's Larry Fink seeking activism, right? Forcing those changes. Hobson's firm is trying to work with companies to really get them to be more constructive and change the way they hire suppliers, look at more minority-owned businesses when it comes down to it. Our Ariel in itself is really trying to invest in more minority-owned businesses as well as work at the companies they invest in. There's something interesting happening that I wanted to point to. This coming weekend, for example, is Warren Buffett's annual meeting. What they are facing is also their own shareholders who are very frustrated with social issues that they're facing, the impacts of their business on the customers and employees around them, and as well as environmental issues. Right now, Neuberger Berman has votes that are out there that are really trying to force change among one of the biggest investors in the world.
So it's interesting. This is growing momentum, clearly, Shanali, for, as you're reporting, for ESG. And it seems like the focus has been on environmental, maybe a little bit less so on social and governance. I mean, even though the tech companies screen well on, you know, environmental, you take a look at some of their super voting share structures, just for example, and that doesn't mark well or grade well for the governance issue.
Yeah, that's for sure. And there's a lot of pressure on the SEC to kind of change the way that they force people to disclose things, right? Because at the end of the day, a lot of this comes down to disclosure on top of, you know, just companies saying that they're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on the social issues in particular, you know, we're coming up on 1 year since George Floyd has been murdered, right? We are also coming up on 100 years since the Tulsa race massacre. You know, these issues are very, very real to a lot of people who are demanding not just change, but also disclosure. And, you know, on top of climate, you're seeing these social issues really come to the forefront of the investment community's minds, and where can they use their own money to create change?
And the race issues as well, which we see in all other facets of American life. It's interesting that Melody Hobson, when she was named the chairwoman of Starbucks, was the first Black woman ever to be the chairwoman or chair, well, I guess it could only be a chairwoman, of any S&P 500 company. So she's making waves there. And of course, as you point out, running Ariel Investments can also vote as an investor. Shanali Basak, thanks very much for that. Let's bring in Kevin Tynan. Joins us from Bloomberg Intelligence. He's our go-to guy when it comes to reporting on the automakers and a senior autos analyst. I don't know if you're a titles guy.
He's
Kevin,
been doing this
senior,
a long time.
Senior autos analyst. Yeah, yeah. I've been asking Kevin for advice on cars for at least 15 years, I'd say. So
he's a total car nerd too. He's got the grease under the fingernails. He's the real deal.
I know we're going to talk about Tesla, but before we get to it, you, me, and Paul have all been pretty interested in the Mach-E, and I think that you've had a chance to drive Ford Mustang Mach-E. It's tough to get at dealership lots across America. It looks so cool, and I've heard positive reports, so I wanted to know, have you had a chance behind the wheel, and what do you think?
I have. I had it for about a week, a couple of weeks ago, maybe about a month ago, and I guess I was totally whelmed, neither over nor underwhelmed by it. And I have to say, it was a little chilly. Well, let me give you two things that kind of jumped out at me. One was I had to drive it to the office, and I don't live far from this office, and we have charging stations here.
Because you live and work in Princeton, I guess.
Right, right. So yeah. I wanted to give it back to Ford with a full charge on it. So I had it charges at 3 miles of range per hour.
Whoa.
So if I left it overnight, I would have had about, 48 miles of range on it.
There's got to be a faster way, Kevin.
Yeah, there is. But I mean, I don't have a level 2 charger in my garage. That would have just been plugging it into the outlet, where I plug my compressor. So, and then when it was full, it only read 180 miles of range. And then the other thing was, while I was driving it in that cold March morning, the big iPad stuck to the dashboard froze. So I couldn't change the radio station. I couldn't change the temperature. I couldn't, because it's sort of like the way Tesla does it, where everything runs through that center screen. So once it froze, and it restarted right away and was fine after, I restarted the car, but it was just kind of strange that I couldn't do anything. I had to listen to Hair Nation blasting.
Had to.
All right, Kevin. So our good friend Elon Musk and Tesla report earnings after the close today. We know that their deliveries came in better than expected. What are you really going to be looking for this quarter?
I think a lot the delivery number was similar to the fourth quarter. So, I think a lot of things will probably be sequentially in line with what we saw at the end of 2020. And I think, I don't know what other people want, but for me, I think what'll be interesting will be the trajectory of the regulatory credit sales this year, right? Those were $1.6 billion last year, and it put them at, $1.2 billion in profit. So, it'll be interesting to see how those reconcile to each other quarter to quarter as we go through 2021.
Does FCA buy all of those in order to make, the Demon, the Beast, the
right.
TRX?
Yeah, and I think GM, did a little hedge, and probably Ford as well, just in case, in terms of the election and if things intensified before they had a chance to get, Lyric and GMC Hummer and more Bolt sales or whatever they wanted to do. But yeah, the majority of it was to the former FCA. And now that it's Stellantis, they're saying by next year they won't need to buy any more credits. And I think that's what's, that's what's interesting to me, is that you're starting to get, even if they're just compliance vehicles, you're getting competing automakers getting to the point where they're going to sell enough of them that they don't need to pay Tesla to be profitable.
All right, that's where I want to go, Kevin. This is the money question, I think, for Tesla in this EV market. It seems to me that if I think about where the comments Volkswagen's made, the comments GM has made, and Ford has made, that these are not compliance vehicles. It seems like they are really going all in on the EV market. Is that in fact the case, do you think?
Well, look, they have to say that, right? And I've, I recently drove the new Bolt EUV, and you're, there with the engineers and talking to them, and it's a great vehicle for what it is. And, and God bless them, those engineers and those General Motors people really believe in the vehicle, and they don't want to hear it when I say, like, yeah, but you really don't want to sell it if it's losing money, do you? So it's something like they have to say it, and I think
are they losing money? Is there not a path to profitability?
There will be, as economies of scale and raw materials cost comes down there, you can see that path. And I think that's part of the reason why you get commentary from automakers that we're going to do this And then they put a 10-year timeline on it, you know, and it's like, well, couldn't you do that faster if you really wanted to do it? You know, why by 2030? Why by 2035 does it take so long to do this? You know, and I think that just comes back to the profit dynamics that are currently in place. You know, look, Tesla's 9 years in and they did 500,000 units last year. You know, it's not a lot.
I actually drove around in a Bolt with Mark Royce once, and he was telling me how great it was. And you don't want to contradict Mark Royce, the president of GM, because he's a big dude, you know? And he can get pretty serious pretty fast. But I was thinking, man, you have a 1963 Corvette C2 split window. You like this thing? You got to be kidding me. But he did seem very enthusiastic. Kevin Tynan, senior autos analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, thanks very much for joining us. This is Bloomberg. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.